From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. An American teenager in Singapore is facing a caning. Depending on your perspective, this is cruel and unusual punishment or an effective way of maintaining order in society. On today's Fresh Air, Understanding East Asia, we talk with James Fallows, author of the new book Looking at the Sun, The Rise of the New East Asian Economic and Political System. Also today, TV themes. We talk with Mike Post, the composer of the themes for NYPD Blue, Hill Street Blues, LA Law, and The Rockford Files. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Bosnian Serb shelling of the Muslim enclave of Garajda continued today, despite promises of a ceasefire by Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. Three rockets slammed into the town's hospital, killing 10 people and wounding an unknown number. At least a dozen other people were killed when shells hit several apartment buildings near the hospital. President Clinton is pushing NATO to approve broader airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs. The alliance attacked Serb positions around Garajda a little over a week ago. Today, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole called for more military action.
The Bosnian Serbs are challenging the resolve of the international community as well as that of the United States. And so far, they've been very, very successful. The pinprick strikes executed by NATO in response to UN requests for close air support in Garajda on the 10th and 11th did not demonstrate toughness, rather timidity. Timidity in the face of a third-rate or fourth-rate military led by thugs.
Within the hour, President Clinton's expected to outline his response to the latest developments in Bosnia. He postponed a news conference in order to talk further with the NATO allies. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry.
We remain of the view that we'll be able to work together with our allies in fashioning a response here, as we have in the situation involving Sarajevo and in other matters involving Bosnia.
State Department spokesman Mike McCurry. Two new opinion polls indicate public support for President Clinton's health care reforms has dropped. Still, 9 out of 10 respondents said they wanted fundamental changes in the health care system. Both polls showed the public roughly split on the president's plan. A USA Today CNN survey showed slightly more people opposing it, while a Harris poll found about 53% favoring the president's approach. Rival politicians in South Africa welcomed the Inkatha Freedom Party today to the final days of the campaign for the country's first all-race elections. Inkatha's decision to abandon its election boycott is expected to minimize violence when voters go to the polls next week. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Inkatha leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi joined the race yesterday after dropping long-standing demands of greater autonomy for Zulus. Inkatha supporters rushed to put up campaign posters in Natal province, the party's stronghold, and Inkatha's first campaign rally is scheduled for today. Cyril Ramaphosa, Secretary General of the rival African National Congress, wished Buthelezi well this morning.
We would like to see him in elected positions of government, participating with all other leaders.
Ramaphosa's ANC is expected to outpoll Inkatha in Natal, though Buthelezi's party is likely to win some seats in a new provincial legislature. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 32.12 at 3587.70 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The House of Representatives is debating a crime bill. By a 5-vote margin, lawmakers voted to keep a racial discrimination proposal in the bill that would allow death row inmates to live if they could prove racial bias was behind their sentence. The House also approved a measure to remove weights and other workout machines from federal prisons so as not to help inmates improve their ability to fight. Lawmakers also voted to give law enforcement and the courts access to criminal histories for use in stalking and domestic violence cases. In Gainesville, Florida, the confessed murderer of 5 college students has received the death penalty. The judge imposed the sentence today, nearly 1 month after a jury unanimously recommended that the defendant die. Russell Lewis of member station WUFT reports.
Family members crowded the packed courtroom as they had for much of the trial and erupted in cheers when the judge sentenced 39-year-old Danny Rowling to Florida's electric chair. The brother of one of the victims jumped up and shouted the names of the slain students will be remembered long after Danny Rowling is forgotten. The judge agreed with the jury's unanimous recommendation that Rowling acted in a cold, calculated, and premeditated manner, and he should die. Rowling's defense attorneys are already planning an appeal, but they had said earlier that Rowling wanted to live, but expected to die for the murders of the five college students in August of 1990. For National Public Radio, I'm Russell Lewis in Gainesville, Florida.
The Environmental Protection Agency says agricultural chemicals are badly polluting the nation's water. A new EPA report says farm runoff accounts for 72% of the pollution in rivers and streams, and it's also the leading cause of pollution in lakes, ponds, and reservoirs. The report cites farming and development as the major sources of sediment that ruin wetlands. In Middletown, Ohio, an explosion occurred at the AK Steel plant this morning. Four people are reported dead and none injured. There's no report yet on what caused the blast. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It looks like the 18-year-old American Michael Fay will be caned in Singapore in spite of American protests against the punishment. My guest, James Fallows, says there's a lesson in this story about the emerging political and economic system in East Asia. The rise of East Asian countries is the subject of his new book, Looking at the Sun. Fallows lived in Japan and Malaysia in the late 80s. For the next 2 years, he traveled extensively through Asia. He's now the Washington editor of the Atlantic Monthly and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. Fallows says there are some common themes that unite most of the countries of East Asia. Economically, they practice Japanese-style capitalism rather than American-style. The state is involved with business to strengthen industry. Politically, these governments are authoritarian and don't adhere to the Western emphasis on individual liberties. I asked Fallows about the forces behind this new system of state-regulated authoritarian capitalism.
I think the main force is one that we almost never talk about, at least in the United States, but that every single day when I was living in Japan or Malaysia was brought up by somebody, either consciously brought up as an item of discussion or was subconsciously implied in things that went on. And that main force, I think, is the era of European colonialism, several hundred years in which, from the Asians' point of view, these white people with big machines and big weapons showed up and took over. And this is a kind of artifact of history from modern America's point of view. But from the perspective of modern China and modern Japan and modern Malaysia, it's sort of the constant burr under the saddle of having the lesson of history be what happens if you're weak, what happens if you're behind, what it's like to have outsiders telling you how to do things and pushing you around. And I think that if you had to choose one force that lay behind what we see now in the Japanese and Chinese and Southeast Asian economies, it would be that, wanting to offset these centuries of weakness relative to the Western world.
Well, this reminds me of something you write in your book. You say that a lot of the Southeast Asian countries feel that they can become as strong as the West without embracing its, quote, permissive ways.
That, I think, is the undertone of this Singapore caning case, to which we might return later on. And I think the reason I tried to emphasize that in my book is it was one of the biggest surprises for me when I was living in that part of the world. We have assumed, again, without having to say it, because we take it so much for granted, that as countries modernize, as they develop, they will inevitably become more like our society in profound ways. They'll become more democratic. There'll be more equality between men and women. There'll be other kinds of individual flexibility. And I think that inevitable convergence is not so inevitable seeming from the Asian point of view. And there is an increasingly articulate and an increasingly unembarrassed expression of the idea that, hey, we can have big machines too. We can have all these scientific laboratories, but maybe we don't need your kind of small d democracy.
Well, let's get more into the caning. How does the caning apply to their theory of progress?
I think we will look back on this caning many years from now as a real watershed, not for its inherent melodrama. I mean, this, almost like the Tonya Harding case, is something that you couldn't think up because it has so many interesting side effects. But because it was the first time when Americans took notice of what many Asians, most notably the English speakers in Singapore and Malaysia, have been saying for a couple of years. And there are different levels of this. One level is there's been this really kind of wearying analysis from Southeast Asia for the last few years that America has become, as Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore finally said 2 days ago, a nation of white trash. And what he meant by that was that there was sort of no individual discipline, no responsibility for one's own behavior, et cetera, et cetera. And the kinds of protest that the U.S. has made about the caning, one's concerning not the sort of extremity of the punishment itself, but whether Michael Fay should be held responsible. This has been used in Singapore just as a demonstration of everything they suspected about the United States, that we shouldn't really hold people to certain rules, that it's cruel to, that when rules impose on you, it's kind of inconvenient and unfair. And so the reason this has been particularly interesting to me is that I've been hearing this stuff for the last, say, 5 years from officials in Singapore and the Singapore press, but this is the first time that it has really caught the imagination of America of how differently they feel about a structure of social obligation and of justice.
Well, I think it's really interesting the debate in America is going from, on one end, people saying, good caning, teach them respect for the law, to on the other end, people just being really appalled by this kind of like corporal punishment. What's the philosophy behind this punishment in Singapore?
The philosophy behind the punishment is one that I understood in a sort of visceral way, because it was the same philosophy that applied in Malaysia when we were living there, which is that if you know that the consequences of misbehavior are going to be dire and extreme, you won't misbehave. You'll be more likely to misbehave. You'll be less likely to misbehave. Now, there are factual challenges that one could present to this assumption. For example, in Malaysia, which, like Singapore, has a mandatory death penalty by hanging for any drug offense. I think the threshold is 10 or 15 grams of any kind of drug, so that one marijuana joint, for example, would be a mandatory hanging offense in either of these countries. Malaysia does still have a drug problem. They have to hang people all the time because it doesn't discourage them enough. Singapore can argue more convincingly on factual grounds that they do suppress the level of crime by having these draconian punishments. I think there's the philosophical level behind that is that Western society is based on the idea that individual rights are what life is finally for, mm-hmm. and individual liberty is what you're supposed to be in business to promote. And they're saying, well, maybe, not so fast. There are certain collective liberties, collective rights, the right not to have your car spray painted, the right not to be gunned down, the right not to be robbed. And these are the sorts of rights, so to speak, they're defending by caning people.
Do you have a position on whether, the United States should try to intervene to prevent the caning from happening?
Yes. I have a bias. My bias comes from my position as a former resident of Southeast Asia and as one who knew exactly what the rules of life were. I knew the things that would get me expelled from the country. I knew the things that would get my children caned when they were there and the things that would get us hanged. And we deliberately did not do those things because we knew them so well, and I'm sure that this Michael Fay knew them as well. So my bias is I start with a certain hard-heartedness towards him because he knew what was going on. At the same time, I have the normal human bias against caning. But my position, my policy position for the U.S. is that the U.S. should have asked for mercy rather than acted outraged about this. If we ask for mercy, we are playing to Singapore's dignity and saying, we recognize that you have your own rules. We recognize that this young man admitted breaking them. Nonetheless, we ask you to be merciful towards him as a sign of your power and this kind of the majesty of your right to punish him, but your greatness in not punishing him. Instead, the way American protests have come across in Singapore is as if they boil down to saying, how dare you? How dare you be so brutal to one of our own? We haven't complained when you've caned your own people over the last two or three decades. This we consider barbaric when it applies to our own people. And that has almost guaranteed that the caning will actually go ahead. And I hope I'm wrong, but I would bet money that this young man will in fact be caned.
That's interesting. James Fallows is my guest, and his new book is called Looking at the Sun, The Rise of the New East Asian Economic and Political System. Where are we now in the trade war with Japan?
We're my stalling and hesitation here reflects the fact of how long this has been going on and how long it has burdened my own tired mind. I think that we're actually moving forward, that if you wanted to argue for human progress, this actually would be a surprising case you could use to argue forward movement, because I think the Clinton administration, whatever its other defects in its policy towards the world, whatever the personal fallibilities its members might have, has a better idea about Japan than its predecessors have had. And that idea essentially is to stop trying to change the essence of Japan. Stop giving lectures about closedness or evil cartels or this or that, and simply negotiate with Japanese counterparts certain results of having a certain foreign presence in the cellular phone market or the auto parts market or whatever, and it gets us out of the missionary mode and more into the negotiating mode. And I think although that offends every principle of how economics is supposed to work, I think it makes a diplomatic and historical and real-world sense, and so I think that's a good thing.
Now, I understand that you briefed President Clinton before his most recent trip to Japan.
I was invited to come in and present some of my ideas to him, you know, along with other people before he went. I have no illusions that I was the guiding hand behind every move of his in Asia. But my theory as a journalist is that I'm in business to do two things. One is to go out and look at things and see what I can make of them. The other is to then disseminate those views. So I felt this was an opportunity to do that at the retail level one by one as opposed to the wholesale level as we're doing now.
So what did you highlight for him?
The time I went to talk to him before his trip, this was right after the killing of the Japanese teenager, I think, in Louisiana, where the man who had shot him was let off by a jury. And part of it, what actually most of the discussion was about, either strangely or not, was the etiquette of how the president should deal with that issue. You know, how should he deal with the issue in general? How should he deal with this boy's parents? What kind of atonement or what kind of apology would be dignified? What part would seem unseemly? So there's a whole lot of discussion about that. More generally, this was also just before the elections last year that brought Mr. Hosokawa to power. And so the main substantive discussion was how the U.S. should position itself, if at all, in this contest among parties in another country. And so the president decided to be more or less neutral about this election, which itself was a radical change, because until that moment, the U.S. government had been essentially the ally, the co-conspirator, if you will, of the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, viewing it as the main kind of American proxy.
So in talking to the president about the etiquette of dealing with this trial, is that similar to asking for mercy instead of condemning the policy of caning?
Yes, and
what'd you tell him?
There was a proposal. There was a proposal that he travel to this boy's home village, which was some distance out of Tokyo. You know, it was a 2 or 3 hour drive, and let's say it would be a short flight there, and then people started considering the logistics of this undertaking, what it would mean to take by helicopter a U.S. president with his zillion-member entourage of Secret Service members and assistants and speechwriters and reporters and pool cameramen, all descending on some poor, hapless Japanese village. And I was saying, other people were saying, look, this village will never recover from that. You know, that they will prostrate themselves in preparations for what would seem to Clinton like a nice 10-minute gesture, and you would probably bankrupt the town by staging this. So that option was rejected. Another option was to have the family and the president meet at the U.S. Embassy. The most modest, and I think the option that he finally accepted, was simply to give a telephone call to this boy's parents and say how much he was sorry for this. Interestingly, political advisors in the room, and not sort of the invited outsiders, were saying, look, that's fine to do. It'll certainly help U.S.-Japanese relations. But be sure, Mr. President, that in the week or so before you go to Japan, you call a dozen American families whose children have been shot, so that we don't have the idea that you only care about foreigners when they're shot here and you don't care about our own people.
Did he do that?
To the best of my knowledge, he did, and they said they wouldn't publicize it, but if anybody asked, they could then say, well, of course, we've been calling these poor Americans, too.
What did you think of that?
I thought that's why these people get the big bucks as political advisors.
Fair enough. My guest is James Fallows. His new book is called Looking at the Sun, The Rise of the New East Asian Economic and Political System. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Fallows, author of Looking at the Sun. Let's move to China for a minute. I feel like we're kind
good.
Of hopping around the world here. But the Clinton administration is trying to link trade with China to improvement in their human rights policy. Does that seem like a productive, realistic linkage to you?
It may be necessary in some moral sense. I think it's almost guaranteed not to be realistic or productive for the following reason. Both in the long-term sweep of China's history and in modern China's current strength, it's very, very hard to find evidence of China sort of knuckling under to outright foreign pressures to do this or that. And indeed, the lesson of the last, say, two centuries of China's history, as seen in China, is about the humiliation of doing that. And the great evil that everyone wants to avoid is the 1830s and 40s and 50s, when the British were debauching them with opium, and the British kind of could make their governments kowtow to British authority. And so it's very hard to say, oh, yeah, this is likely to make them change their ways if we lecture them publicly. The U.S. is in this trap, both a trap of its own ideals. We can't say that we're in favor of prison labor, we're in favor of rounding up dissidents, we're in favor of squelching dissent, and we're locked in legally to this kind of annual thumbs up, thumbs down verdict on China for trading status. We're in a awkward situation of facing the need for hypocrisy. What I mean is the following. I think we need to keep saying things we believe in. We need to say arresting dissidents is bad. We disapprove of it, and we're going to criticize you politically. At the same time, I think it would be foolish and self-defeating to cut off trade dealings with China. Number one, it wouldn't change their policy, at least in the short run. Number two, there's lots of other people they'll trade with. Number three, it would hurt us as well.
What should we be learning from the Southeast Asian nations?
We should be learning a sense of wonder about how big the world is. And I mean the world of ideas about how people live, because this is something that, in my view, is not precedented in our national history of having a really different scheme for organizing people succeed. You know, we've been used to thinking that there's the primitive third world, which deserves our pity, but not really any kind of serious study because it's mainly mainly wallowing in different difficulties. And this is something that isn't based on our ideas and yet does succeed very well. And so the main thing we should learn is that it is a big world that we can spend a lot of time looking at closely.
During the years that you were a journalist working in Japan and other Southeast Asian countries, did you find that your etiquette had to change as an interviewer when you were trying to get information from people?
Oh, very, very much so. And this was one of the hardest things for me to learn. Many American journalists have, understandably, a sort of meter is running mentality all the time. When I first got to Japan or Malaysia, I was sort of interviewing in that Sam Donaldson mode. You know, it's not my nature as a person to be that way, but that was sort of the professional mode I was cast in. I had to learn a different kind of patience and indirection. I think there were two things in particular I had to learn. One is the necessity for small talk, in specific small talk about the weather, that unless you spend the first 10 minutes of a Japanese interview talking about, oh, isn't the spring nice this year? Yes, but the winter was cold, and probably the summer will be hot, but then the leaves will fall. That this was the necessary grease for any kind of interaction. And if you didn't do that, it was like not wearing shoes to the interview. So that was one lesson I had to learn. The other was the exact meaning of a Japanese word that is usually translated as being difficult. This is muzukashii. The dictionary translation of that in English is difficult. What it actually means is no way. And so I would say, well, you know, what are you going to do about North Korea? And I say, oh, that's difficult to answer. I say, well, yes, it's difficult, but what is the answer? And what they, in fact, were saying was, we are not going to answer this question. And I learned after a while that things were difficult. And in fact, I've incorporated that into my own American dialect, and I find myself frustrated when people don't get the point. And I say, oh, can you come to this meeting? Oh, that would be difficult. I'm saying no, but they don't understand that.
Right, right. Now that you're back in America and interviewing people here again, have you gone back to your Sam Donaldson approach or maintained some of the Japanese style?
I think I've fallen into my chameleon-like fashion. I've fallen into the ways of my current Washington hometown.
You have a great story about a lunch in your new book where you write that you learned quickly that there was a certain kind of French restaurant that you could only go into if somebody was treating because it was just like exorbitantly priced, like $250 a person or more per lunch. Tell us about the dessert that was served at one of these restaurants.
When I was a college student, I always worried if somebody took me to lunch in a restaurant, I was worried the whole time who was going to pay because I knew if I had to pay, I couldn't do it. And similarly, when I was in Tokyo, that thought was on my mind through every moment of the conversation, who was going to pay for this because I'm going to be bankrupt if I have to. So there was one of these French restaurants with some Japanese bigwig who was giving me a theory of Japan's mission in the world. And I was sizing up the cost, as I so often did in Japan. I thought it would be a couple of $100s. And then I realized how grossly I had miscalculated when the dessert came out. And it was this little cup of chocolate mousse. And on the top, where you might have shaved chocolate or curls of chocolate in New York or Paris, were curls of pure gold. I don't know how much gold there was in money terms, but there was a lot of gold. And I had to eat this gold along with the the chocolate. And I had both a kind of physiological and a larger moral revulsion as I was eating it, thinking, gee, I could pay a day's rent if I could somehow sneak this gold off. So, but that symbolized the confidence of that era in Japan.
What did the gold do to your digestive system?
Well, we don't want to go into this too deeply, Terry, I think.
It didn't agree with you, huh?
I noticed it not. I had no further kind of awareness of it, but as it was passing through sort of the upper part of the digestive tract, that is my mouth and esophagus, it reminded me, I remember thinking, this is like Saran wrap, that if I wanted to fool somebody in the future, I'd get some Saran wrap and color it gold and tell them that it was gold, because it had kind of that feeling of that tasteless. It was texture only, no taste as it went down.
Now, how did you kind of weigh your moral revulsion toward and physical revulsion toward eating gold against knowing that if you didn't eat it, you'd be insulting your host, assuming he was picking up the tab?
At that moment, I thought either he's picking up the tab or I'm bolting. There's no way I'm being stuck with this. It wasn't a contest. I realized this is the only time in my life I'm going to have a chance to eat gold. I'm going to see what this is like. The moral revulsion was more kind of all the symbolism of what it meant to be in a culture at that moment where people could afford to do this and where my host clearly reveled in my discomfort. I mean, he knew that I was on a dollar salary. He knew that I was sort of pairing cheese to get by in daily life. And I think there was a certain laboratory experiment going on in his mind of what does it look like. This actually was a man who had been a translator for the U.S. occupation forces and so had earned his food 35 years earlier translating for these big beefy GIs. And now here was a representative of the children's generation, you know, the children of those GIs, whom he could put through this exercise. So it wasn't malicious on his part, but there was a certain enjoyment I think he had of watching me cope with the gold.
James Fallows is Washington editor of The Atlantic Monthly and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. His new book is called Looking at the Sun, The Rise of the New East Asian Economic and Political System. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, writing catchy TV themes. We talk with Mike Post. He composed the themes for NYPD Blue, Hill Street Blues, LA Law, Law and Order, and The Rockford Files. In the meantime, you can listen to our catchy theme, composed by Joel Forrester.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton is expected to respond to the latest developments in Bosnia within the hour. The president is said to be pushing NATO for more airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs. Some members of Congress want the president to ignore a UN arms embargo against Bosnia and send weapons to the country's Muslim-led government. Three Bosnian Serb rockets struck the Garajda hospital today, killing at least 10 patients and wounding an unknown number. Other shells killed at least a dozen people in apartment buildings near the hospital. The attacks on the Muslim enclave reportedly intensified today, despite another ceasefire agreement. Peter Green reports from Sarajevo.
The latest peace offer from the Bosnian Serbs appears to be more of a UN surrender dictated by the Serbs. A UN spokesman says the agreement essentially binds the UN to muzzle Garajda's Muslim defenders. But the agreement only covers the left bank of the river, where most of the Muslims are located. The right bank will remain a free-for-all. The plan also sets the scene for a humanitarian disaster. 60,000 people will be crammed into 4 square miles, most of its steep hills, in half of a city built for 20,000. The UN says the city would be overpopulated and underfed, and all access would be in Serb hands. With the Serbs still shelling Garajda and the Bosnian government refusing to even discuss the Serb plan, peace will not come to Garajda today. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Green in Sarajevo.
The UN's World Food Program says an unknown number of Rwandans were killed at the border with Burundi overnight and today. Officials say shooting broke out when thousands of Rwandans tried to escape the chaos in their country by crossing over into Burundi. Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency reports Rwandan police are holding about 6,000 people in a stadium in a southern town. The agency says some people have been pulled out of the stadium and killed. The government of Ukraine says two mishaps occurred this week at the crippled Chernobyl nuclear power plant. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The IAEA inspectors were conducting a 10-day review of the Chernobyl plant, one of whose reactors exploded in 1986 and led to the world's worst nuclear accident. Several other reactors at Chernobyl remain operational, and on Monday, a short circuit led to a drop in the water level of reactor number 3. This was classified a minimal 1 on a 7-point international scale, measuring the seriousness of nuclear accidents. The other mishap occurred on Tuesday when a control arm placing nuclear fuel in one reactor failed. That did not receive a classification. The Ukrainian government said no radiation was released in either case, but was clearly embarrassed that these incidents occurred during an IAEA inspection. The agency has issued a report saying the Chernobyl complex is unsafe, and several Western governments have called for its complete shutdown. The agency plans to discuss its findings tomorrow in Vienna. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 21 points to close at 3598.71. Declines led advances. This is NPR News. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen says the recent increases in short-term interest rates will not choke off the recovery. But testifying before a Senate subcommittee today, Bentsen warned if rates continue to rise, the economy could slow down. The Treasury Secretary told senators he didn't see why the Federal Reserve decided to raise interest rates. Some lawmakers said they were concerned with the Fed's recent actions. About 1,500 health care workers demonstrated on the steps of the Capitol this morning. Protesters said they deserve the health care benefits just as generous as what members of Congress have. They said only the Clinton health reforms or a single-payer government-run plan would give all Americans the same coverage that lawmakers currently enjoy. The government reports today that housing starts shot up last month by 12.1%. The Commerce Department says starts increased in every region of the country, including a 30.4% surge in the Midwest. This sharp increase nationwide indicates a strong rebound from the winter slump, but some analysts warn rising mortgage rates could slow construction again. David Ressler is one of them.
This could end up being the high number for the year, largely because higher mortgage rates are going to slow down the housing sector. And we are coming off a very high level of housing activity, a level that was not sustainable even if mortgage rates had not moved up. So we expect to see some decline in the level of housing activity from this March level as we move through the year.
Economist David Ressler. Former Reagan advisor Paul Simmons has died at age 52. Simmons came up with Reagan's famous 1980 campaign slogan, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" Former President Nixon is still in critical condition with swelling of the brain. Nixon suffered a major stroke on Monday night and has been in and out of intensive care since then. Doctors thought he was doing better yesterday, but they now say the former president has taken a turn for the worse. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you read TV credits, you'll recognize the name Mike Post as the composer of lots of TV themes, like NYPD Blue, L.A. Law, Law and Order, Hill Street Blues, Quantum Leap, Wise Guy, The Rockford Files, The A-Team, Hunter, and Magnum P.I. Mike Post has a new CD called Inventions from the Blue Line that features his music from NYPD Blue. Mike Post, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What were you told was needed for the NYPD Blue theme?
Not much. It's kind of a funny story. I've been working with David Milch and Greg Hoblit and Stephen Bochco for many, many years. And so I'd read David's script and made an appointment to have lunch with Bochco and Hoblit to sort of discuss how I could get started musically. We went to lunch, and they're old and dear friends of mine, and so I finally, conversations got around to the project, and I said, well, you know, tell me, Stephen, what have you been thinking? What have you been, you know, give me some direction, you know, be a producer. He said, well, he says, I've been thinking quite a bit, and I've come up with one thing. And I said, well, what's that? He said, drums. I said, yeah, well, what about them? He said, no, drums. He said, has there ever been a theme that was just drums? I said, no, and rightly so, you know. He goes, no. He says, drums, that's what I got to say. And so I said, okay, fine. So I looked at Hoblit and I said, Greg, what are you thinking? He said, well, I've been thinking a lot more than that. He said, I've been thinking Subway. And I went, what? And they said, yeah, Subway. I said, so you two geniuses, the most decorated guys in the history of television, you know, you're going to say drums and Subway. And they said, that's all we're saying. And they started laughing, and we went on with our conversations about, you know, other things. And a couple of minutes later, I said, you know, there's a way to do that.
Now, I'd like to compare your NYPD Blue theme to another cop show you did also for Steve Bochco, and that was Hill Street Blues. What was the assignment for Hill Street?
Well, there wasn't. Hill Street happened a much sort of a more spontaneous way. I hadn't read a script. I went and saw the finished pilot, but it didn't have a main title, and I was just blown away by it. I just thought it was
probably one of the best shows I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, I just was really impressed by it. And we went back to Bochco's office, you know, same cast of suspects, you know, myself and Hoblet and Bochco. And so we went back to his office, and we all started talking. And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, what would you do normally? I said, well, it's such a gritty, streety show, you know, I've something very funky. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. I said, but you could go completely against it. You could do something that really, you know, is not streety and funky at all. He said, what do you mean? I said, maybe something poignant, you know. And he said, well, why don't you try that? Why don't you do something different? So I went back to my studio, which at that time was six blocks away from where Bochco had his headquarters. And I just sat down. It happened right away, just instantaneously. I mean, within 30 minutes, I had it. And I called him up. I said, you better come over here. And he said, what are you talking about? You just left here. And I said, no, I know, but I've got something I really like. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. He said, he came over and he listened to it. And I played clink and clang, clink and clang, you know. And he said, play that again. I went clink and clang, do 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 do. He went, yeah, do that. And he walked out.
It's a very reflective theme for a cop show.
It ended up being that way. It sure did.
Why don't we hear it? Talk a little bit about how the style of theme music for dramas and action shows has changed over the years that you've been writing. For instance, I know this is before your time, but in the early 60s, you know, Private Eye shows all had jazz themes. By the early 70s, the action shows had, you know, like Son of Shaft kinds of themes
right.
with a wah-wah guitar and everything.
Right. Well,
this was in the SWAT team era.
Right.
Where do you come in musically, and how has the style changed since then?
Well, I'll give you, you know, there's an answer that might lack humility here, but I'm going to give you an honest answer. My partner, Pete Carpenter, and I think changed that with Rockford Files. Before we got into doing music for television, I don't think anybody that was or had been doing music for TV had a rock and roll background. I believe that just about everybody, in fact, I know that everybody that was in the medium was either came from jazz roots or from classical roots. And my partner, Pete Carpenter, had come from a jazz background and a big band background and had some legit training. But I'm a rock and roller, first, last, and always. I mean, I Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Ray Charles, I mean, that's where I started. And I learned to read and write and orchestrate and conduct, but my heart is still, you know, if I was going to be anybody but myself, I'd probably want to be Keith Richards, you know, so... we were the first on TV with those sensibilities. So after that, a bunch of guys came in and said, well, gee, we got to be more, we have to be more in tune with what's happening. So, you know, hence Waka Waka, you know, hence they decided to do exactly, as you well identified, Son of Shaft.
So you think you kind of ushered in the Son of Shaft era?
Well, I think we ushered in rock and roll sensibilities on the little tube. That's what I think. I think we did that.
Why don't we hear the Rockford File theme? You think that's where it started?
Yep.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Mike Post. His themes from NYPD Blue and Law and Order are featured on his new CD, Inventions from the Blue Line. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Post. He wrote the themes for NYPD Blue, Hill Street Blues, Law and Order, Quantum Leap. Here's his theme for LA Law. Tell me how you wrote this theme.
Another crazy Bochco story. You know, I can't help but make this guy sound like a maniac. He's not a maniac. He's just really smart. He wrote the script, and then we had about 8 months before it was actually even going to be produced. We'd just come off of Hill Street, which was very successful as a TV show and successful as a record as well. We had won Grammys and Emmys and all kinds of things, you know, for our work on that show. And so then we'd had a not so successful little adventure called Bay City Blues. It lasted 4 or 5 shows. It was about minor league baseball, and it wasn't very successful. So now it was important to Bochco's career, more so than to mine, that this really be successful, this L.A. Law. So, and we had lots of time, no air date staring us in the face. So it wasn't up for grabs as to whether I had the gig or not. It was mine. I just had to come up with the right piece of music. So I started to write, and I delivered a piece of music to him, and he said, gee, this is great. And a day later, he called me and said, you know, it's really good, but what else could you do? I said, well, hell, I like writing music. I'll just keep writing. So I kept writing. I came up with the second piece, same thing, third piece, same thing, fourth piece, exactly the same thing. So I said, okay, this has gone far enough. He liked every one of them, just not well enough to make them the main title of L.A. Law. So I said, you and Greg Hoblett, come over to my office. We're going to have lunch together. So they came over, and I didn't have any food there or anything, and I sat them down on the couch, and I said, before I take you out to eat, we're going to write this theme together. And they said, what do you mean, write this theme together? I said, well, it's real simple. I said, let's discuss the show yet once again. We'd already discussed it, you know, ad nauseum. But we sat down and said, okay, here's what the show is. The show is the law. And they said, right, the show's the law. I said, so that means to me it's got to have majesty. It's got to be big. It's got to be powerful. And they said, right, it's got to really have a lot of nobility to it. Right. I said, French horns, guys, that's what French horns are. And I had a sample up, so I played him a French horn sound. Yeah, that sounds like it. Great. I said, now I'm just going to start playing little licks, and when I come up with something that anybody likes, you guys say you like it. So I was dinking around, and finally I went, boom, 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 ba-da. And they went, oh, I kind of like that. It's a great keeper. Okay, we keep that little phrase. I said, now, what else is this show? Well, it's California. Right, it's California. It opens up, I mean, it had already been written in the script. We open up with Arnie on a freeway in his Porsche that says litigator on for the license plate. So, okay, California. Well, I can't do the Beach Boys, guys, because that's going to sound almost like a joke with the French horns. But maybe I could get a great big drum sound and do something almost like Born in the USA. And they said, yeah, that's good. That was relevant at the time. So I punched a drum machine, and I had a great big snare sound up that went, and they said, oh, we like that. And I said, you like this tempo? Yeah, great. So I had this tempo, and I went, boom, 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 ba-da. And they went, yeah, okay, I like that. And I said, okay, now what else is this show, more than anything else? And they looked at each other. I said, this show is sex. And they and I said, Bochco, it's you. You're writing about what you always write about. You know, the bathroom, sex, craziness, nuts. And he said, yeah, you're right. And I said, alto sax. And he went, yeah, you're right. So that's how that theme was written. It was basically written with them on the couch saying they liked a lick or didn't like a lick. And I just sort of pieced it together with them sitting right there. And it took about 45 minutes or an hour. And I said, now get out of here and let me put it all together. And they loved it.
My guest is Mike Post. His themes from NYPD Blue and Law and Order are featured on his new CD, Inventions from the Blue Line. More with Mike Post in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah. What do you have?
Hi, Terry. Ann Cooper reports tonight from South Africa on the beginning of the Inkatha Freedom Party's election campaign. Inkatha leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi is urging his followers to vote in the election. Linda Wertheimer talks with a Rwandan human rights monitor about her escape from Kigali and the trouble that she saw coming before the plane crash, killing the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi. U.S. independent insurance agents are gathering from around the country in Washington to talk about health care. And we'll discuss the intelligence of dogs with the author of a new book, The Border Collie and the Poodle Are on Top, The Afghan Hound is Way Down.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Mike Post. He composed the themes for NYPD Blue, L.A. Law, Hill Street Blues, and Law and Order. You've explained that rock and roll is the music you're most passionate about. But when you were young, when you were 24, you became the music director for the Andy Williams Show. This was in 1969. Now, if anybody represented the opposite of rock and roll in 1969, it had to be Andy Williams. How did you feel about working on that show?
Weird. But he was such a nice guy, and it was a chance to write for an orchestra every week, you know, 20, 30 minutes of arrangements. And it was a real laboratory. And I got a chance to be the youngest, you know, guy in the history of TV to do that gig. And I also got a chance to break some ground for rock and rollers, for guys that were, you know, that liked the same music I did. So it was strange, you know. One of the reasons they hired me was because Andy was going into an 8 o'clock time slot. They needed a younger sound. They knew he was definitely, you know, an AC kind of an artist, you know, and in those days they called it MOR. He was definitely an older skew to his music, and they needed somebody to sort of surround him with younger sounding stuff. But they also needed somebody that felt comfortable with an orchestra. So let's either get that guy that did, you know, arranged and produced Classical Gas, that was me, or let's get Jimmy Webb, and he was too busy writing great songs, and so they got me.
So you produced Classical Gas?
Yes, I did.
So when you were the music director for the Andy Williams Show, to give him a younger image, did you have him covering the pop tunes of the day?
That's right.
What would you have him cover?
Well, just about anything that was hot that I thought was within his reach. I mean,
what would be within his reach?
Well, I don't know. It was the softer stuff that was happening at those times. I mean, we did some smoky tunes, and we just made them a little softer. And the one thing I never wanted to do was take a guy that sang as well as Andy did and make up, you know, like a caricature out of my, you know, the producers would come in and say, well, let's have Andy sing Proud Mary. I said, let's not, you know. I mean, let's not have Andy sing Proud Mary. That's not a good idea, you know. That's not going to work. But Andy singing Tracks of My Tears, if done the right way and not trying to compete with it, you know, a David Ruffin version of it, might work. So we did some interesting things.
A musician who I know who used to be in a band sometimes played TV themes in his gigs, and his rap was that he thought TV themes were really America's folk music because that's what everybody grows up listening to and sharing in common. What do you think?
I don't know. I guess he's probably right. I just never think of myself in terms of history or in those kinds of important things. I mean, I hope it's true. I hope it really is true. But It's a little scary to think of anything you're doing that way. The first time I ever became aware of some of these feelings was when I first released the Rockford Files as a record, and it became a hit just in one of the first days that it really had become big. I was driving from the San Fernando Valley down into Hollywood one morning during rush hour, and I was on the 101 freeway, and I was stuck below a bridge, and everybody had their windows open. It was a hot summer morning, and a guy pulled up next to me as we're inching along in a convertible, and we happened to have the same radio station on, and all of a sudden the Rockford Files came on, and he reached down and turned it up, and I turned up my radio, and it was like we were in stereo, you know, and he could tell that I was listening to the same radio station he was. The windows were open, his top was down, and he's bopping around, bouncing over, and he looks over at me like, God, great record, huh? And I kind of wanted to say, hey, man, it's me, you know, but I didn't. I just smiled at him and went, yeah, bitchin' record, you know. And it was, I mean, that's the first time it ever sort of like went, well, I'm not alone on this freeway, you know.
Right. So it says in your bio that you are a world-class arm wrestler, and who would have thought that there was such a category for arm wrestling?
Well, this is, you know, I'm going to take that out. That's an old bio. I'm taking that out. This is embarrassing. You know, it's true. I did, a number of years ago, I was looking around for a sport that I could get into that would keep me at a certain weight, and that would keep me in real good shape. And I found that I was pretty good at arm wrestling. And so I participated in a number of world and national championships in which I placed. I was never a champion, but I was, you know, a close third or fourth. And so that got into my bio, and somehow it stayed. The only good thing about arm wrestling is, number one, I don't do it anymore because I ripped about every tendon I have in my right arm. But it did get me to running, and I'm still a marathoner, and I'm still running, so that part is good.
What do you win when you win?
Pretty sore arm. I don't know. It wasn't for money. It was for trophies.
It wasn't for money. It was for glamour.
It was for glamour. Exactly. Yeah. That was actually, it was the intellectual intercourse between the participants that really drew me to the sport.
No doubt. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you, Mike Post, for talking with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Post has a new CD called Inventions from the Blue Line. It includes his theme for NYPD Blue. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Our interns are Devin Reif, Ann Neville, and Philo Holland. Welcome back to our director, Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret revolution behind South Africa's elections. We talk with South African journalist Alistair Sparks about the nearly decade-long secret negotiations that led up to next week's historic event. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.